is the Criminal Law Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 2, May 3rd, 1969, Room 401, State Capitol Building. Today's subject, sexual offenses, preliminary draft number 1.
Don, why don't you take us by the hand and lead us through?
Well, I think it might be helpful if we went over this explanatory information here that Gene Laverano prepared. Not that it makes a whole lot of difference, I suppose, in evaluating the merit of this draft, but this was drafted by a woman lawyer, and I think that it certainly reflects some ideas in here that I wouldn't go as far as to say they're revolutionary, but they're certainly a departure from what we've come to look at some of the sex crimes here in Oregon. But anyway, I think it's the draft is set up in such a way that you just about have to look at the whole thing to see how it all fits together. But she has set out here what specifically what she's trying to do. And some of the interests, she set out two interests that are to be protected under this, protection of the individual against all non-consensual enforceable acts, sex acts, and then protection of the young from sexual advances, which these aren't new ideas in the law, but these are specifically the things that she zeroed in on and tried to get rid of some of the old notions that really, in many respects, are unenforceable as a practical matter anyway. But now, one thing that it would eliminate would be any sexual activities engaged in between spouses. There's some fairly recent cases in other jurisdictions on this very question. For example, a charge of sodomy against a husband. I have more to say about that a little later, but
I've heard of what?
Sexual conduct engaged in between consenting adults to eliminate homosexual conduct as a source of a criminal charge. Any consensual activities engaged in by adolescents where the parties involved are within 4 years of age of each other. And this is probably going to be one of the most technical parts of this draft. trying to see how these relationships are distinguished on the basis of age. So we have, as we go through the draft, she sent out definition of terms. And rape, 3 degrees of rape, 3 degrees of sodomy, 2 degrees of sexual abuse. And the sections relating to rape, sodomy, and sexual abuse are divided into degrees based on the following factors: the age of the victim and the age of the actor, or two, the mental or physical condition of the victim, or the use of force or threats. And of course, as the span between the defendant and the victim increases, then the liability would increase proportionately.
Sorry, I got caught in the middle of a motion at 9:30.
That's what we understand.
Well, we're just starting in on this sex offenses.
Sex offenses.
Preliminary draft number 1. On the definitions that are used throughout the draft in the various sections, Section 1 sets those out. Definition of sexual intercourse has its ordinary meaning and occurs upon any penetration, however slight. Emission is not required. Nothing new about that definition. Deviant sexual intercourse means conduct between persons not married to each other, consisting of contact between the sex organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another. 3, sexual contact means any touching of the sexual or other intimate parts of a person not married to the actor for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of either party. Four, mentally defective means that a person suffers from a mental disease or a defect which renders him incapable of appraising the nature of his conduct. Five, mentally incapacitated means that a person is rendered temporarily incapable of appraising or controlling his conduct owing to the influence of a narcotic or intoxicating substance administered to him without his consent or to any other act committed upon him without his consent. Physically helpless means a person is unconscious or for any other reason is physically unable to communicate unwillingness to an act. Forcible compulsion, physical force that overcomes earnest resistance or a threat expressed or implied that places a person in fear of immediate death or serious physical injury to himself or another person, or in fear that he or another person will immediately be kidnapped. Need to spend any more time on the definitions at this stage. As is usually the case, the best way I think to see how these work is to look at the specific provisions. Before we get to those, Section 2 does set out some general provisions that would apply throughout the article, beginning at the bottom of page 4. With respect to lack of consent, whether or not specifically stated, it's an element of every offense defined in this article that the sexual act was committed without consent of the victim. And then we set out presumptions: a person is deemed incapable of consenting, he's less than 16 years of age, mentally defective, or mentally incapacitated, or physically helpless. Mistake as to age: in any prosecution under this article in which the criminality of conduct depends on a child's being below the age of 10, it is no defense that the actor did not know the child's age or that he reasonably believed the child to be older than the age of 10. When it depends on the child's being below a specified age other than 10, it is a defense for the actor to prove that he reasonably believed the child to be above the specified age at the time of the act giving rise to the charge. This is, of course, would work quite a change in existing law. A mistake is
just going through an overview now, I take
it. Yeah. Just mistake as to consent. It's a defense for the actor to prove that he engaged in conduct and that he didn't know the facts or conditions responsible for such incapacity to consent. Spouse relationships. Husband and wife relationships would be excluded, as well as persons living together as man and wife. And sexually promiscuous complainants. We use prostitutes. The only evidence that could come in. Prompt complaint, also a new provision, although some of the cases have looked at that as standpoint of raising some inference if there's been a delay, an unreasonable delay, but this would spell it out. And 3 months would be the cutoff point, unless the child, unless it was a child less than 16 years old, then it would be up to the parent or guardian to notify the authorities, and they would have 3 months after learning of it from the child. Let's move on over to we're going to obviously have to come back and discuss in detail some of the rationale behind these provisions, but I think it's helpful if we look at the specific there. Well, page 22 is where we pick up section 3. Rape in the third degree, and there we have the element of age 16, and we have the new element requiring that the male is 4 years older than the female. 2 is set out in brackets just really for the purposes of discussion by the subcommittee, by the commission. Rape in the second degree, There we have the elements of mental defect, incapacitation, or physical helplessness. Here the age is 14, the male is 18 years or more. And the highest degree, rape in the first. There we have the element of force, or if the female is less than 10 years of age. And then we have sub 3, which is retained from our existing law with respect to family relationships. Making that a more aggravated offense.
Is our present, just stop for that for a moment, Don. Is our present non-consensual, no, that's not right either. Is there an enhanced penalty presently for rape on a sister? There is for daughter and stepdaughter, but is there for sister?
I think it does cover both. Person convicted of raping his sister of the whole or half blood, or his daughter, or the daughter of his wife, shall be punished.
I never remember sisters being in that.
Yeah.
I never had a sister, so I guess I wasn't interested.
So this is really pretty much the same as what we have now. Well, I don't know. Maybe we ought to go ahead and discuss rape if you want to at this stage. On page 34, we get into sodomy. And really, some of the considerations are the same with respect to force and whatnot. Might be well to
start discussing
the rape offense.
Well, maybe definitions.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any trouble with it. Anybody have any problem with the definitions on starting page 2?
Just look through them again.
Write them down and see.
As usual, I'm well prepared.
Without seeing
how they're used.
How they're used.
Well.
The deviant sexual intercourse, I think, bears a closer examination because that's limited now to conduct between persons. It wouldn't include human-animal type of situation. That would be...
Also makes a change as to whether or not the persons are married.
Yeah, right.
Which is something new, is it not?
Yeah, right.
Well, let's... not closing the door to coming back to that. Let's go to section 2, which is on page 4. But I think you had a question somewhere along there, and I have one when it come up. Lack of consent, page 4.
Well, the only thing that bothers me, and since I don't practice in this field, is that there are several parts of this section now, and the mistake is to age, and the mistake is to consent, and so on. To talk about defense for the actor, I suppose the defendant, to prove. Now, do we run into any problems that we did in connection with, what was it, not Leland, but something, was it Leland or something came on later, where it used to be that there was a degree of proof of the defendant had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, first of all, that he was insane if he relied on that.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, the Supreme Court, either in the Leland case or in some later case, said that. And I don't practice criminal law enough to know what is the present status of this idea of proving defenses.
Well, no, at the time that case, the Leland case, was decided that the burden was on the defendant to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And that burden was sustained by the court. They said, that's all right, it's not unconstitutional. But we do have a lesser burden now, it's preponderance. But the burden is still on the defendant. And our present proposal that that covers the insanity defense retains that same burden by a preponderance of the evidence. And we've also now, we've looked at a couple of other areas where, because of the nature of the knowledge and that it be peculiarly within the knowledge of the defendant, we've placed the burden on him in a couple other instances too. Professor Platt's draft on inchoate crimes, for example, we have the defense of renunciation and a charge of attempt to commit a crime or solicitation or conspiracy. And the burden there is placed upon the defendant mainly because in our present law it's not even a defense. So we don't really recognize the defense of renunciation in this state. But the Model Penal Code writes it in as an exemption in their attempt drafts and their proposals. They not only say that it's a defense, but really they make it an exemption, which keeps the burden on the state. But Professor Platt's feeling was, and I agree with him on this, is that if we're going to move in this direction and allow this to be raised by the defendant, that it isn't an undue burden to make him prove it by a preponderance of the evidence.
I policy-wise, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think that when you get in the position that the state would be in effect having to prove negatives,
yeah,
and prove negatives by a beyond a reasonable doubt, you got a burden that's almost insurmountable.
And as a practical matter, when you say the defendant has the burden by preponderance, if he puts in anything, he's home because the state is going, sure, it's going to shift it back to the state to overcome this anyway. But as a constitutional proposition, we don't think we have any problem with this kind of an approach. Actually, this the way this draft is set out, it's really would be more of a break for the defendant than we have under the insanity defense, because we just stated as a defense, which there's nothing indicated here about the burden of proof, and the Model Penal Code approach is that when it's stated in terms of merely a defense, that the burden is still on the state. Really, it just amounts to what Michigan has called the burden of injecting the issue. Whenever they've had an instance where they're allowing a defense, although sometimes they call it an exemption, they nonetheless state it as the burden of injecting the issues on the defendant, but this does not shift the burden of proof. So I think this language we have in the sex offenses draft would be construed to mean that the burden's on the defendant to raise the issue, and once he does that, then the burden would then be on the state to overcome it, and they would still have the burden of proving guilt beyond reasonable doubt. And
what's the significance of 10? Is that just below general puberty? Is that what the...
Well...
Rather than 12, for instance.
This is a... Here again, anytime we talk about ages, they're fairly arbitrary, but 10 was a common law age for rape. If you were 10, you were presumed, or below 10, you were presumed incapable of consenting. Of course, that was practically middle age, the old days.
Big enough to carry water.
You know? and then over 10, it wasn't rape unless force was used. Mentioned the commentary, Lord Hale's rule, or something like that. But now the Model Penal Code, I think, uses 11.
I'd be inclined to go with 12. I don't want to raise you one, but somehow it sounds like we're in West Virginia. Seven years are okay.
Yeah. It's going to be a delightful bit of legislative history.
12 unless the girl's from West Virginia.
That's right. The Ozarks or something.
Well, I'm almost inclined to agree with you about the 12, for the reason I think that, at least I hope the children, until the time they get out of grade school at least, are pretty unworldly up to this point, and that's about the time they're getting close to getting out of grade school. They're getting up around the 7th or 8th grade there.
I also think, isn't that about the time that most women go, girls go into puberty, I think?
Well, we're getting a nod from the secretary on that.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough session.
Our expert witness.
Now, the commentary on the page 6 talks about this a little bit. It's generally held that reasonable mistake of age does not constitute a defense. And the model penal code dug into this pretty thoroughly when they were working on this question. And there's of course, one of the most recent cases, and I think it's mentioned in here, is this California case, which for the first time recognized a 1966 case, I think, with respect to mistake, allowed a mistake of age as defense. Our mistake provisions here are taken from the model penal code.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that wherever 10 has been used in this context, that it be amended to 12.
Any discussion? All those in favor indicate their favor by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Carried.
Mr. Chairman, I have another question I'd like to ask Don about. Page 5, Don.
Yeah.
Spouse relationships, down there, third line of that subparagraph, subsection, rather. The exclusion extends to persons living as man and wife. You got that defined anywhere? It's what living is, going to a motel together for the night and registering as man and wife sufficient to be living as man and wife?
No, it isn't defined, but it contemplates well, what we think of now as, say, lewd cohabitation, mm-hmm. for example, a common law relationship. It would be an actual living together, holding themselves out as husband and wife. That really, what the draft is trying to get at is their personal relationship with one another, and that whether or not they're legally married would not be controlling.
But I'm inclined to agree with Bud that persons living as man and wife, there's no time limit. You might say, sure, they've lived together 7 years. They thought they were married, but the certificate was bad, or some such technicality. I have some sympathy, but a guy that goes to a motel and spends a weekend with a friend, they very well may cook and watch television and play bridge or whatever man and wives do. And
that's about all man and wife do.
Oh,
yeah.
And
then what do you have? Kitchen privilege.
Whether she can cook, yeah. But gosh, I am afraid that'd be a real.
Where is it effective?
Why not? Can't we work in an idea of living as man and wife other than in a casual or...
Yeah, under colorful compliance of matrimony or...
Well, I don't know. I don't think... I wouldn't want to put a person in... Supposing they just decide they're going to live together. And this is going to happen more and more in our society. People are just going to live together without getting married. And it may be a relationship that lasts for a couple of weeks. It may be one that lasts for several years without them getting married. It's coming. There's just no doubt about it. And I don't want to put those people, frankly, myself, in any different position for the purpose of this kind of law.
Well, then let me ask, are we eliminating the crimes of lewd cohabitation?
That's what I wanted to ask. Where does this come into play?
Well, it comes into play just with respect to the sex offenses. Now, lewd cohabitation isn't covered here. In this particular draft, but the section here on general provisions, you see, makes it clear that no place, when we're talking about rape or sodomy or anything else, are we dealing with spouse relationships. We're saying, in effect, that what the people do in their own home as husband and wife. It's no business of the criminal law.
Or boyfriend and girlfriend, if they have, whatever the requisite period is.
Well, I think it's not so much a matter of period that we should be looking at, but a matter of intent. In other words, we don't want to say, I suppose, that just the merest casual relationships, unless you're willing to go the whole way, which I am, to have taken the approach that was taken in England just a few years back, and say that no act is criminal if done between consenting adults in private.
Well, I'd say that
which
this
I'm willing
is
to go
effectively
for.
What we've got.
We've got two votes.
Well, yeah, really. I think that's what this draft says right now. But
well, that's why I'm trying to make sure whether living meant going to a motel for the weekend. Frankly, I see nothing wrong with this. This doesn't perturb me at all, because I'm willing to go the whole bore that they did. I don't know whatever happened in England with that. Did it ever pass or is this proposed?
I think that was the same time they made they got rid of the homosexuality offenses.
They just said flat out there was no act between consenting adults done in privacy that was a crime. That's what it boiled down to.
No. But you see, where this becomes important, as far as normal sexual activity between these people, it wouldn't be criminal under this draft. But the question might come up with respect to deviant sexual intercourse, where you're talking about sodomy and this type of thing. And although it's consensual, might be some question, unless we specifically indicated in here that we're not talking about husband and wife. Because the way our present law is drafted, it's broad enough, it does cover marriage relationships.
Don, might you not be talking about rape if the couple were young enough and living together as man and wife, like a young couple running away from home, who would be close enough together in age to ordinarily come under, say, third day? One of the rape statutes, they'd be exempted because they were living together as man and wife.
Yeah.
Well, you're to the point that Bud was saying, as long as they're consenting, as long as you have the statutory willingness.
Well, the problem there is they would not be adults. They wouldn't be consenting adults, they'd be consenting minors.
Let me see if I can get this straight, Don. As to marry consenting adults, we have no problem. We're going to say that the bedroom is the bedroom and the state's not interested there. How about when we get to consenting adults who are not married, sodomy would still be a crime under this draft if we feel that we're talking about the weekend liaison as opposed to the renting an apartment together situation. Is that generally right?
Yeah, because now we define sodomy in the third degree, for example. Call it deviant sexual intercourse with a person not his spouse.
Well, you're just this living together is the very crux, as I see it, of how you're tying these in as to whether or not you're going to count them. And I don't think there's a person at the table who agrees that we have to insist that they are legally married or even de facto married. I don't, unless Wally, that Ben
well,
Wally.
No, I'm trying to think of some sheriff knocks down a motel door, and there's a relationship here that would be. The question then is presented to the district attorney: were they living as man and wife?
Mm-hmm, that's.
How do you determine man and wife? The only one true way of doing it is whether you have a certificate, whether you are in fact married. And if you're not, then what?
Well, but this goes on to say, regardless of the legal status of their relationship.
What kind of a Pandora's box are we opening? I'd rather, if the point that we're going to is that consenting adults, let's go to consenting adults and don't hide behind this.
I agree.
This bit here, because I'm, gosh sakes.
We got to spell out some other things. If we just go consenting adults, then Don's going to have to do some revising where the people have not reached the age of majority.
Yeah, I agree. But what I'm saying is, I think we.
Seems to me we're being hypocritical.
Yeah, we're saying this only extends to the spouse.
If you get married, you can engage in any type of sexual activity you want to, but if you're not married, we'll let you have intercourse, but then we're going to regulate the type of sexual activity you can engage in. And I
most of this business, or so-called deviant sexual intercourse. It's just going back into.
It'd be interesting to have some
time when people hit it was all.
And if you had some studies, medical studies on what is deviant, what isn't, I would doubt that our definition of it would meet the medical.
In fact, there's an awful lot of marriage manuals that are encouraging just the very sort of thing that we're willing to say if you're not married, that's a deviant sexual intercourse.
Well, that's right, yeah. This imposes separate standards, there's no question.
Maybe you stoned here in Marion County. I realize you fellows come from a more sophisticated
area, but.
No, you just practiced law under Mrs. Pratt's fault. She was beating down the door.
I'd be inclined to go along with Bud, and I think what Harold's saying, that let's call a spade, and not, except for the minor aspect, let's not raise any difference between spice.
Well, I certainly...
Think you pass the floor to the Senate?
That's next session, I give you a better. Yeah. See, and that reminds me of something before I forget it, Don. I wish you'd talk to me in the next few days to see whether or not there's a budget that's going to carry you through necessary work with the next legislative session.
Pass the House, I think.
But what I'm making sure of is that carries that you will be available during the next time. This whatever committees get this next time, assuming we get a report done. They're going to be lost without you around.
Well, our budget goes through.
It does, for sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah, that covers a full 2 years.
Good. They didn't aren't knocking it off at the...
In January.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
No. No, it's okay. Well, do you want to go on now, or do you want to try to amend this, or do you want me to...
Why don't you work on that?
Okay.
Let's take up what you think we can do that is still valid today, then, if it's all right with the chairman, with the idea in mind that there's going to have to be some basic redrafting.
Well, we could redefine spouse relationships to, in effect, we'll go from here, meaning that spouse relationships are consenting adults. We might want to change the word spouse relationships, but
I'm not sure that's the best drafting approach to it, Wally, is what I'm getting at. Maybe he can go back and do something with these sections, carrying through the idea rather than trying to patch it at one place and then finding it falls apart at another by patching it today in one place.
Okay.
I don't know, Don. What do you think?
I think you're right.
Yeah, I think that'd be a better way to handle it.
I have one other thing. Sexually promiscuous complainants. I've read somewhere here. Isn't that evidence? I've seen a lot of trials, and I've seen evidence admitted as to the conduct of the
buzzsaw syndrome.
Yeah, the conduct of the complainant, and maybe they just didn't object to it. But it's not admissible into evidence nor defense now.
Well, the majority of states don't allow it. The common law was that that's prior unchastity of the female wasn't a defense. Some states have allowed that, but you get into this area of promiscuity and you start talking about chastity and things like that.
We're kind of clarifying it by allowing a mistake as to age, really.
Yeah, but with respect to sexually promiscuous complainants, the only thing that would be allowed to come in would be a question of whether or not she's a prostitute.
And that's defined in the statutes, isn't it?
I think it has a pretty common
meaning. Yeah, we don't define prostitute.
Supreme Court just did.
Yeah.
Common prostitute.
Where would we be? Are you saying that you can, at this point, you can. In one of these kind of cases that, let's say, of rape, that the defense would no longer be able just to raise the issue that she was promiscuous and that this bore upon her credibility as to whether this particular act was rape?
Yeah, in other words, he wouldn't be able to bring in his old hell person and all get up and testify, well, we've had sexual relations with the same plaintiff. The only thing that would come in would be evidence that she was a prostitute.
Would he be able to bring in evidence, not a specific act under this, I'm asking you now, not for policy, but under your draft on, would the defendant be able to bring in evidence, not a specific act, but a general reputation in the community for promiscuous behavior by the complainant?
Not just promiscuous behavior. He could bring in general. I think he'd be allowed to bring in general reputation as a prostitute.
Well, he could also attack your credibility as a witness, but you're talking matter of defense.
But not by that type of evidence.
No, the point is, you see, we have a serious policy decision. Are we going to cut out
a defense,
either specific acts of promiscuity or a general reputation for it? As bear, which really only go to bear on her credibility in connection with a particular act anyhow at present. They're not a defense. You can't rape a girl just because she shacks up with somebody different every night. It only goes to her credibility now when you bring this in, when she claims that the one particular act was rape.
On page 15, Don, she's got commentary.
What's the policy behind the doing this, Don, in your own mind that makes this advisable?
Well, I think the Model Penal Code talks to it pretty well. On page 8, they mention that with respect to their reputation and whatnot, that say inquiries may be justified involving older girls where the offense is the defendant's corruption of innocent but capable females. But if we proceed on the hypothesis that girls under 16 lack capacity for judgment in this area, it's something of a farce to inquire into their virtue. Previous sexual experience might well betoken previous victimization, which should not be a defense to the subsequent victimizer. However, one can envision cases of precocious 14-year-old girls and even prostitutes of this age who might themselves be the victimizers. Accordingly, the draft, while rejecting the concepts of virtue, chastity, or good repute, permits the defense that the girl is a prostitute. This subsection recognizes defense when the victim is an underage prostitute whose lack of consent is based solely on the fact of legal incapacity to consent.
Oh, wait a minute now. There's where I see. I just didn't read. Subsection 5 here on page 5, then, only refers to under 16 type cases?
Yeah, this is under sections 3.
That, and each one of those is to a victim under 16?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Completely off. Don't worry about it.
But we do, the commentary does mention prostitute, I think. About the inquiry, about the definitions.
What was it? Well, my whole thinking was completely off. Don't worry about it.
Okay, anything else on mistake?
Well, now, I think this mistake as to age, probably want to discuss pretty thoroughly.
Where is that?
Well, we have... Of course, below 10, we say in effect that, 12, excuse me. We're saying in effect that if the defendant engages in sexual activity with some child of this age, that we're not going to allow a defense because this, we look upon that as pretty abnormal behavior.
How precocious Lolita is.
Yeah. But if it's above 10, then, or 12, excuse me, then... And even there now, you may feel that that's cutting off pretty young. You may want to have it, say, 16 or something like that. But
well, that
may be too high.
That leaves us right where we are.
It's unrealistic.
Yeah.
We all know better.
But you know darn, yeah, that's right, you do.
What if you're 18?
You know, and...
You're 18, the 14-year-old may look a little different than she looks now, but...
Well, yeah, and of course we've taken that in consideration, the way the draft is...
No, what I'm getting at is unrealistic to think about these female children, once they get by 12, aren't getting pretty damn worldly today. They're having dates in grade school, for Christ's sakes. And
particularly when you get some of the younger defendants, where there's really not that much difference
in the ages.
Not only in the ages, but in their experience and
maturity.
Charity and everything else, and that really the defendant in some of these statutory rape cases is really the victim. You know,
because the girl got pregnant.
Yeah,
in a lot of cases.
these are from a technical drafting standpoint, these are tough problems to try to spell out what we're getting at and have it make much sense. But the model penal code and the approaches that the other states have been taking is to try to distinguish and say that, well, when you get down in the teenage category, that there's going to have to be quite an age span before the law's going to get too upset about it. Because recognizing that kids today, and using the term kids advisedly, you know, that they're a lot more sophisticated than they were a few short years ago, really. And
yeah, damn it.
That's legislative history.
Well, you know, so much of our law in this whole field just doesn't recognize what people like Kinsey have shown us. The male sex drive is at its highest from about age 16 to around 24, and the female in the mid-30s. And unfortunately, our society doesn't match up the two.
People versus Hernandez was the case I was trying to think of, a California case in 1964. And that really made quite a departure in the law with respect to mistake of age. And before that, just about, not only in this country, but every place else, mistake with respect to statutory rape was an offense. But this was a California case. They allowed the defense. And here it was reasonable mistake, an objective kind of test rather than subject. The rule that knowledge of the victim's age is not an essential element of the crime of statutory rape, and that therefore justifiable ignorance of age is not a defense in the prosecution for that crime, is apparently an exception to the general rule that guilt attaches only where the accused intended to do the prohibited act. But
Ellie, you just raised the point that we missed, didn't you? You just had to flaunt it at us. Don, going back to page 5.
Yeah.
Now, in this language down here, when the criminality depends on the child's being below a specified age other than 12, it is a defense for the actor to prove that he reasonably believed. Is that subjective to him? In other words, supposing that, does that go on his mentality, his experience and so on? Or am I simply being, if it's simply a matter of semantics, if we were to change that, does it make any real change to say for the actor to prove that a reasonable man in the same or similar circumstances would have believed?
Well, I think the way this is drafted really is a subjective.
Yes, I
test.
Think it is.
Yeah.
And I've never have been so sure, you see, there's any real difference. Because if you take in all the circumstances, which this appellate courts are just shuck out the ones that they don't want to take into consideration, it really, in the final analysis, if you said all the circumstances, it comes down to that person's own mentality and experience. But
except that you got to sell it to a jury, it becomes what every individual member of the jury subjectively thinks was reasonable.
Well, I think then we should, what you said to us a minute ago, because we just didn't catch it as we went through, is that we ought to make up our minds whether or not we're going to phrase this in terms of a subjective test or an objective test. Isn't that what you said a few minutes ago? What you were trying to indicate to the committee we ought to really take a look at.
This would be he reasonably believed, and of course when you, like you say, when you're trying to determine whether he believed something reasonably, you're really you have to evaluate what he did in connection with what any reasonable prudent person would do under the same or similar circumstance, I think, anyway. Maybe it's pretty academic, but I think that we could phrase in such a way that there wouldn't leave any doubt that...
We want the reasonable man test.
Well, I don't know. I'm inclined to think that it's a question of... He's still going to have to be putting a burden on him here, remember, first of all, the defendant. And sure, he's only going to have to prove subjectively, but to do so, he's going to have to, if it's a mere matter of his own experience or a mere matter of his own low IQ or something of that kind, his lawyer is going to have to develop through evidence that particular aspect of it. Now, he may have a mental deficiency to the point where he's not incapable, you know, by reason of it. But still, that it was such as an inability to appreciate certain factors.
And that does fall, too, though, doesn't it, but under the reasonable man test and the same and similar circumstances situation.
That's what I always say.
But a man with a reasonably prudent man with a bad leg, he would have gotten out of the way of the car.
Yeah, well, but you see what I'm getting? I'm not sure we're saying, but the point I raised a minute ago, we may be saying exactly the same thing in two ways, and we may always be saying that, except in the way that appellate courts apply it, and except perhaps in the way that trial courts are going to instruct on it, and the different emphasis in applying it when you don't stop to think that maybe both tests really are the same in the final analysis. The way it's applied, and the manner in which it's phrased, make a hell of a lot of difference in whether or not there's going to be a conviction or an acquittal at one level, and at the other level, whether or not an appellate court's going to say there was error. I myself am in favor of leaving it this way, but I think that it's a decision we ought to make, and a decision we ought to be ready to defend to the full committee.
Yeah, and of course, we could expand in the commentary, too, what that's worth, to make it clear that we're looking at what this defendant believed.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps what we need is an expression at this point by the subcommittee of a policy, whether we want to, let's put it just this way so we don't get into an argument about whether they're the same or not, whether or not we express it as an objective test or express it as a subjective test.
Any points we'll take at all?
And you can look at it this way, if you, that to allow it at all really is quite a departure. In other words, this is moving away from the traditional view that says that when you engage in sexual activity with certain age girls, that you do it at your own risk.
No warranty of age.
Yeah, and that you proceed at your own risk. So. Since we would be departing from that to even allow the defense, you might feel it's going too far to say, well, we'll let it just be what he reasonably believed, and that we're going to, since we are going to allow the defense at all, it's no burden to make it a reasonable man test. I'm not saying I necessarily subscribe to that, but I think that
I'd go along with that, feeling that the mental abilities and capacity of the defendant would be part of the evidence that would be put on under that test.
Let me ask
my error there.
Well, I was just going to ask this question, throw this up to me. I get into these things that I don't know anything about, like criminal law, and I talk too much. Is it as we would be saying words something like this, and this is it a defense for the actor to prove that a reasonable man in the same or similar circumstances would have believed the child to be above the specified age? Now, is the defendant in a case in which he reasons going to be entitled to an instruction, assuming that he puts in some evidence about that is really sort of about his own mental capacity, is put in through some psychiatrists, we say, and through lay people who have observed him from the last 15 years in his neighborhood and so on, is he going to be entitled to an instruction from the trial court saying that this is one circumstance which the jury may take into consideration in determining, in other words, is this one of the circumstances? Go back to the obvious situation. If the guy with the bad leg, could a reasonable man in all the circumstances, including a bad leg, have gotten out of the way? You see? Now, we've got to go one step further. The mental dullness may not be...
Which doesn't border on a defense normally.
Well, that's a tough question to answer, but I'm not... And I'm not sure we'd ever be able to try to anticipate what the courts might do on.
I think, John, what I'm saying is, if you leave the language the way it is, I think the defendant would be entitled to such a consideration by the trial court. And I think if we go the other way, I'm not sure whether he would be or wouldn't be, but probably my hunches might not be.
Should he?
Well, I suppose there is.
What we're boiling down to, probably.
Well, yeah, I think the first question you have to answer is, should he be allowed the defense at all? And do you think that's a good idea? Do you think that's a...
I think if you get the situation, we'd all would agree with it, where the young girl looks 19, acts 19, appears to be 19, that we want the defense.
Which is totally different from what Bud's saying. Really, we're trying the girl. We're trying the appearance as we see it. So I'd be inclined, I mean, all right, you can take, lead me around full circle. But I don't, I question whether one's dullness, for instance, the old story about, which compounds the problem, is it's difficult to tell the age of, say, the Chinese. The old story, I can't tell a 12-year-old from a 22-year-old or some of these Chinese women. And I think perhaps that would be an element, but I don't think that the dullness, I'm not very good at telling age. I could try to beat the rap every time by this. I think it's going to be tried on the basis Harold talking about. Not how smart am I, but what did that chick look like? Would she have trapped the rest of us? And I think that's how it's going to be tried.
Practical matter of the poor defendant could just, at the time of the act complained of, just snap a picture. Well, be pretty good, but when that DA runs that girl in there with her dress 2 inches below her knees and her hair in pigtails, and
you're just going to have to advise your clients to have their handy Polaroid with them, you know.
Keeps her away from her usual environment for the night before so she doesn't show up with a hangover, you know.
Well, really, that's really what they're trying to get at here with this, allowing this defense, is the reasonableness based upon the victim's appearance, and precociousness, and whatnot.
Well, of course, you're making a good argument. And the thing that bothers me, Don, is that since you realized this as you went along, why did you put it in subjective, in what appears to be subjective term?
Well, I didn't draft this, although I reviewed it and discussed it with Jean as she was working on it.
She had a little more sympathy for men than our sex has.
Yeah, actually, there. That's why I mentioned it at the outset here.
He warned us.
And I'd move that we, as a policy matter, go to the reasonable man test as opposed to a subjective test. They're intermingled, it's hard to say it that way, but that we're going to view the conduct of the complainant and the circumstances surrounding the act as to whether or not he acted, he was reasonable in a mistake of age.
Okay, all those in favor of Mr. Haas's motion to change it to a reasonable man as opposed to a subjective test, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Carried. Anything else?
You want that spelled out specifically in the statute?
I think you could do it very easily by changing that language. Just say it as a defense for the actor to prove that a reasonable man in the same or similar circumstances would have believed the child to be, etc. Don't you think that would do it?
Yeah.
Maybe I don't want to say that to adopt it now, but I think it's that easy to change the approach. Any legally trained person would immediately pick that up, but that is an objective, in quotes, test.
Now, with respect to the burden of proof, what's your feeling on that? Do you think that we should leave it the way it is, which I think that if we just say it's a defense, the burden is going to be on the state? I don't know whether you...
I mean, after he introduces evidence to the effect that a reasonable person would have believed the child to be above the age, then the burden falls on the state.
I think it would, yeah.
Burden's on the state in all cases, in criminal cases. Anyhow, if the guy remains silent, you still doesn't put on any defense. You still got to.
Well, he'd have to raise this defense.
No, but I don't think we're changing anything. We're allowing him to interject. This is all. This is all we're really doing, is allowing him to interject this, unless we go further and say that he has to prove it by some.
Yeah, that's all this does, just allow him to bring it up.
What is your thought? We ought to put it like insanity, make him prove it then?
Well, I don't know. I think something can be said for making him prove that it was reasonable. That it's a reasonable mistake of age, proved beyond by preponderance. But this is a little different, I think, than certainly it's different from insanity, but because there you've got presumptions of sanity in the case, but so he's presumed to be sane to start with, but here, and I think this is different too from the situation respect to renunciation, where you've got things that are peculiarly within the knowledge of the defendant. The appearance of the girl and this sort of thing isn't knowledge that the defendant should know any better than the state, you know.
Don, the thing in the back of my mind that's bothering me is that I guess it was in Leland when it went up, they did say that this was not unconstitutional, but it just sticks in my mind somewhere along the line that the Supreme Court of the United States dealt with that again afterwards, it wasn't an Oregon case perhaps, and got into this whole question of where you have provisions that the guilt must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt of putting burdens in, and I hate to say this, I don't know what the case I'm talking about or even that I'm right. There's just this nagging feeling in my mind that after Leland there was something else that adopted. I think there was a dissent in Leland, and that later the Supreme Court went towards the Supreme Court of the United States, that went towards the dissenting view. Maybe I'm just dead wrong. I may be confusing it with something else. And this would color our thinking here, I think, about what we could do.
Well, there have been some fairly recent cases where you have statutes that presume guilt. For example, where the defendant is put in if he's found, say, under a vagrancy statute or something like that,
after hours in Portland.
Yeah, where you presume, unless he gives evidence to the contrary, that he's engaged in some illegal activity or something like that, where they've gotten into a situation where they've said, well, in effect, you're making him testify. You're making him, either way, you're putting him on a dilemma, because if he doesn't come forward, to overcome this presumption, he's going to be found guilty. You're presuming his guilt. But in order to overcome that, he has to waive his self-incrimination privilege.
Are they stricken those down?
Yeah. And I don't know, that may be one that you're thinking about, which is really not quite the same thing.
Well, we get so darn tied up in any of these cases with the fact that the state of Oregon, if my memory serves me, treats presumptions differently than the majority of the states. The presumption is a higher beast, a higher order of beast in Oregon than it is in most states. There are some cases, and these are not just criminal cases, but going back into the civil cases, in the law of evidence, we treat presumptions in the way that a minority of the states do. Most states, there's very little difference between an inference and a presumption. And a presumption can disappear from the case completely when overcome. In Oregon, as I recall the law of evidence, a presumption does not disappear completely.
It can go to the jury, I think, on the presumption. Whereas in the majority of
cases, I think that's right.
It can be overcome, and then you don't get to the jury.
So then we get into problems with different things. And then we get into the idea of what does prima facie mean in the criminal law. And we have these DUIL statutes, which say a guy's prima facie under the influence of his blood alcohol content is a certain level. Does this require him to come forward?
Yep, it does. Doesn't it?
I don't know. I'm not so sure, but all you're saying is that if you show that, you can't non-suit the state. In effect. Once you establish that, there's no way you can non-suit him.
I think you just still go to the jury. And I think a defendant can remain...
I think he can remain silent on it.
Not as a practical matter, but perhaps as a legal matter.
Well, I think as a legal matter he can remain silent. I don't think the state's entitled to a directed verdict on the prima facie.
Oh, no, I don't
think it makes a jury question for him.
Yeah, I don't think that there...
So then how far much further do we go if we say... You know, then we turn around if we say that he must prove by a preponderance of the evidence here, are we requiring him now to come forward?
Well, but I think that there's a difference, because if in the driving while intoxicated situation, if he wanted to present a defense that he was a epileptic, he's going to have to present that evidence. The state's not going to have to negate that. They're just going to have to prove facts, which will get them to a jury. Here we're saying that if they prove the elements of the crime, if he's going to assert that there are unusual circumstances, such as that she appeared to be of the age to give consent, he's going to have to present those facts.
Suppose he just offers evidence that she looked older. Now, he would not be entitled to a judgment of acquittal on that.
It'd probably go to the jury, yeah. He's instructed upon.
Oh yeah, I don't think he'd be entitled to judgment of acquittal.
No, it'd be a jury question.
Sure. It'd go in.
Just
what would the instruction be that would be formed along the statutory language that Bennett has raised the defense of mistake of age, and if you believe, I don't see how the state would be required to, if what you're saying is the state would then have to put itself back in the position and offer by a preponderance of the evidence that she did look 12, you know, or under 12. I think we're putting the state in an impossible position because they're not even in a position to get the Polaroid picture. But I don't think we're putting them in that position.
I think it's practical matter they'll do it anyway.
You know, there's one other thing. Carry this just one step further. Supposing that the defendant doesn't put on one damn bit of evidence on whether or not this girl is 15 or looked 15 or a damn thing. And the only thing is, does he have to mark her as an exhibit on cross-examination or something? But the jury sees her. Now, he wants to raise the defense without ever taking the stand or putting on any case at all himself. He simply wants to raise the defense based on the way she looked right as she was in the courtroom.
Could the attorney argue?
The point is, supposing he doesn't put on one bit of evidence, we say that he has to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence. Aren't we saying that either he must adduce evidence upon the case in chief, which he can use, as we all know he can use on the prosecution case, or in his own case? Supposing he wants to interject this defense, but only by what the jury themselves can see in the courtroom, when the complainant is testifying and present.
That's one subtle change we've made, because by changing the object, we remove the requirement that he testify. If we left it subjective, there's no way, he would have had to come on the stand and testify.
I don't think that he has to either way is what I'm getting at. I think that he may just leave that to the jury, but if we say it proved by a preponderance of the evidence,
I think he'd have to present evidence.
There's nothing other than, as you're saying, marking her as an exhibit.
I don't think
because
he'll get
suppose
the instruction.
How could you ever have an appellate court
handle
the thing if the only thing that he was relying upon, unless he marks her as an exhibit.
I don't think he'd get the instruction. I think the trial court would say there's been no evidence put in the record in this case which would justify a reasonably prudent man to make a mistake as to age. He's going to have to come forth with
supposing his only
school
evidence is her appearance. Supposing his only evidence is her appearance. Right?
Well, then he'll have to take a picture of her and put it in.
Well, I don't see how he could get an instruction on it if he doesn't have something in the record.
Why? But what the jury has seen in that courtroom, thank God, I attach a tag to her leg and put her in evidence. Then you don't want to keep her. You don't want to take her to the jury room, though, because there might be undue influence.
Of course, as a practical matter, that really comes in now. I mean, it certainly influences juries. You know, the appearance of the.
But you wouldn't be able to argue it.
You wouldn't be able to argue it.
No, you couldn't. No, no.
You wouldn't get an instruction on it.
No, you wouldn't.
I don't see any way around that, though. But
I don't either. I think that it's something he doesn't have now.
All right, why don't we leave it up to the appellate court to spell out what we mean by prove, then, rather than say that he must prove it by a preponderance of the evidence. Maybe what we're saying is this, Don, instead of saying that it's a defense for the actor to prove it, maybe we're simply saying that evidence is admissible. No, that doesn't do it either.
Yeah. It's almost more than a defense, it's almost an excuse. It removes the crime, really.
Well, I'm not really too satisfied with this language we've got in here with respect to defense. Whichever way we want it, I think we can spell it out better than we've got it, because by just saying a defense, now other places in our drafting we've used the words affirmative defense and or made it clear that the defendant has to come forward. But then we go on to say for a defense for the actor to prove, and of course the language to prove implies that he's got the burden. And if he does have the burden, what kind of a burden is it?
I think he should have to do it by preponderance of the evidence.
I could write it, I think, suppose you wrote it something along these lines. When criminality depends on the child's being below a specified age other than 12, wouldn't do it either. I was going to say no crime has been committed if a reasonable man in the same or similar circumstances would have believed the child to be above the specified age. But then that gets the guy off the hook that knows that the child was below the age, but a reasonable man wouldn't have.
I should have known.
Yeah.
It's a toughie. See, the model penal code says it's a defense. Well, it's the model penal code language is where this came from. They say it just about the same way we do. It's a defense, the act to prove, but they say by a preponderance of the evidence, though.
No, but putting, well, going back to some of this thing we adopted a little while ago, when we adopted that objective test, did we write out the guy who knows otherwise, the particular defendant who actually knows? I think maybe we did. I think we have to add some language that if it's not excused if it can be shown, if the state can show that he knew, no matter whether a reasonable man would have believed it or not.
Well, yeah, but wouldn't you say one of the circumstances is that he knows her age? In other words, a reasonable man under the same or similar circumstances. Suppose he's the pediatrician or the obstetrician, delivered the child, knows full well.
Registrar of Vital Statistics.
Right.
So,
of course, wait,
that would be one of the circumstances.
But it says, I think it covers that, but it says, but it is a defense for the actor to prove that he reasonably believed.
But we changed that language. We said we'd go to the objective wording. Now
we got to take care of that.
You go back to he reasonably believed instead of the so-called objective test, then we don't face this dilemma. Because if he actually knew, he couldn't have reasonably believed otherwise, no matter what her appearance was.
But do you think you'd be successful in arguing to a jury that we don't care what the reasonable man is, or we don't care what he knew, it's what a reasonable man, he had evidence that a reasonable man wouldn't have?
No, but supposing he takes the position as a legal matter of law, he's entitled to a dismissal if the jury finds and asks for instruction, a legal instruction, you see, pertaining to the court. No matter that, it isn't a case of whether I knew or not, it's a case of whether or not a reasonable man.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say one of the circumstances would be that you're the pediatrician, or you're the Bureau of Vital Statistics, or you're the neighbor, or couldn't you?
All I'm afraid is that he's got it, the way you've written it, that he can at least have the judge present to the court. That his knowledge, his own knowledge is immaterial.
Well, I don't know, though. If you say, would a reasonably prudent man in the same similar circumstances, or one of the similar circumstances, is that he knows how old she is.
Okay. I don't prosecute cases.
We'll fight with Burns over this.
Yeah, I can imagine. Are we saving those roles?
No, we get to this, we'll have fights with Burns on everything that comes up anyhow. It doesn't make any difference.
That.
Well, I don't know. That didn't occur to me, frankly. I did point you raised, but I think it's good.
Well, at any rate.
Well, now.
Are we taking too much just time?
No. I think these are really important issues, and I'd rather spend a lot of time on them now and get them thrashed out here than have trouble with them later, because. But on this mistake now.
Well, for instance, suppose the strawberry on the market floor. You know, a reasonable person could or should have known the existence of the strawberry. That is, I mean, if the clerk really knew it was there, then that becomes an objective test under the same codes. Do you think you'd be entitled to a non-suit to if the clerk's testimony is, well, I don't know any difference whether I should or could. Maybe I should or could have. But I knew it was there.
I think if you had this case under these circumstances, and the state would then come forward and show that the defendant lived across the street and attended the young lady's 8th birthday party 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, then it wouldn't be conclusive, because you could say he forgot, but I think you're going to get the evidence in, and you're going to get the same practical effect. If he takes the stand, and he's not going to take the stand and say, I knew how old she was.
speaking of Safeway, I was in here for a little.
Since the last time I talked about Safeway, your Uncle Mom suited me.
Sorry about that.
You can handle it by saying, for the actor to prove, no thanks. That he did not know the true age of the child, and that a reasonable person in the same or similar circumstances would have believed the child to be above the specified age. Now you get them both there.
You make him testify.
Well, I don't know whether you do or not. You can prove what he knew by other evidence other than his own.
I don't know. I think the effect of whatever language you put in here is going to make him testify. If he wants to use his defense, I think he's going to take the stand.
Yeah. Probably so, but you hate to. You don't want it in the statute where it really, where we get back to the after hours ordinance again. But
we're not carrying the case. The difference between that and this is we're not carrying the case to the jury and giving the jury a presumption that he did know. Now, to make it like the after-hours case, I think you'd have to say here that the state proved that the child were under age 16, that then it's presumed that the defendant knew it. Then you'd force him to take the stand to overcome the presumption. You'd force him to come forward with evidence, whether he took it himself or not. You'd force him to come forward with evidence to overcome the presumption. But we're not saying there's a presumption that he knew. In your after-hours cases, they in effect just said, if you're out on the street after whatever it was, midnight, between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m. in the morning, the usual statutes ran along and presumed that you're there for an unlawful purpose or something.
Yeah.
And they just hit you because they had a presumption.
Yeah. We're saying it's an affirmative defense, in essence, is what we're saying.
But I'm not sure that we have to say by preponderance of the evidence. Do we have to spell it out? Do we leave the court to spell it out?
Well, I don't know.
They come forward and they say, well, no legislature ever said it. They say such things. Well, certain things have to be proven by clear and convincing evidence. Even though our statutes just say a preponderance of the evidence.
But when we fit this whole code together, though, you see, we're going to have sections where we say it's a defense. We're going to have sections where we say it's an affirmative defense. And we may end up with just a real hodgepodge if we're not careful as we go along. And
how do you view the difference between a defense and an affirmative defense?
Well, I think that if it's just stated as a defense, this is really analogous to what Michigan calls injecting the issue, the burden of injecting the issues on the defendant. He has to bring it up. But the minute he brings that up, that's all he's got to do. The burden is not on him to prove it. The burden is still on the state to prove everything, including that issue, beyond a reasonable doubt. Which means, in effect, that saying the state does have to prove a negative, I guess. But I'm not so sure we can write that out of the law, even if we wanted to.
I think if we leave it objectively, though, we still have not required the defendant to come forward himself. It would seem to me that his lawyer can still draw the jury's attention to the appearance of the complaining witness with the intent of raising the defense as a mistake to age, because it's what the reasonably prudent person under the circumstances. If we put it subjectively, then I see no way, but they didn't have to get on the stand to testify. Now, I think because it proved that he reasonably believed, if we leave it as written, he's had to get on the stand. I don't make it one way or another. I don't see any problem there. But I think there, then it becomes I think we've got to be careful when we raise these issues in criminal law, that the only way you can avail yourself of the defense is by taking the stand.
I think if we keep it objective, though, we're not saying he has to take the stand.
No,
we're saying there's all kind of evidence that
we're at a different point there than where we are with the problem we're raising and thinking about this moment.
Yeah, I don't think the objective test of reasonableness is the same point we're at now. And Don's point is if we say proved by a preponderance of the evidence, then we're going further, much further than Michigan. If we just leave this to prove, then all he has to do is bring it up. Now his lawyer might well do that by calling the complaining witness back to the stand and saying,
"Did you wear your skirt?"
Identify her. Ask her about the kind of, try to get her to admit the kind of clothing, so on. And or maybe do nothing more than saying, "Your Honor, I called her back to the stand only so that the jury can look at
at the complaining witness, bearing upon the defense which we are raising under the statute of showing reasonable belief. Just for the jury at this point to look at her, Your Honor.
Jury view.
Well, a jury view ordinarily is not evidence, but I think a jury view of a witness on the stand, first of all, that goes to credibility. We all know that. They have that. And I think it's sort of a funny thing because I've never thought before about whether or not general appearance of a witness on the stand is evidence. I don't think there's, I think it's evidence, clearly, although it doesn't go to the jury room, that if you, the plaintiff gets on the stand like this, there's some evidence that he had that injury. And we all know as a practical matter that that is a species of evidence, even though it doesn't go to the jury room. Ordinarily, what the jury hears,
evidence or species?
What the jury hears and what and what the exhibits are evidence. We sort of take a position because otherwise most appellate stuff would have to go out the window.
Well, like scars,
what you see is
deformities.
Well, and really it may not be evidence on a particular material element or material allegation, but with respect to evaluating the testimony of a witness, guys, you get instructions. The appellate court talks about it all the time.
The opportunity to view them.
The view and listen and the manner in which he spoke and the demeanor of the witness, yep, and all this stuff. No question about it that it's considered.
I really think you should have to prove it.
Now, it's interesting to note on this point. Now, the model penal code has tread very lightly with respect to putting the burden on the defendant in any place throughout their code. They've really been very reluctant to shift this burden over to the defendant. But interestingly enough, with respect to mistake of age, they do spell it out, that the burden's on the defendant to prove by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I interrupted Bud, or you, before you'd answered Bud's question. What does a defense mean? Have we drawn a distinction between excuse, defense, affirmative defense, and various categories of duties or whatever?
Well, we haven't really spelled it out, but
then you say a defense, you just have to raise it, and it would go.
Okay. How about
affirmative defense? You'll have to prove by preponderance.
I can think of a civil example that you could raise the same thing. Supposing that I'm asking for damages for a client on the basis of cosmetic injury only, a scarring. And that's what we allege in the complaint, that she has sustained a scar 4 inches long above her right eyebrow. Let's assume for the sake of ease that I go in to prove my case and the defense comes in and says, we admit that the defendant was guilty of negligence, failing to maintain a proper lookout. There is no defense of contributory negligence, so the only question is upon the matter of damages. All right, so for the matter of damages, I don't bring in the doctor a darn thing. The girl gets on the stand, and I simply ask, Your Honor, may she pass down close where the jury can view her? She goes down, this is also in the record, goes down, and I don't put anything else except the jury looking at her and arrest. Now the defendant says that he's entitled to a non-suit because there is nothing in the record, no description verbally of a scar, no exhibit, no photograph of a scar. I'm just assuming I prove a lousy case, and naturally you're not going to do all this. But to raise this point, that all that the guy thinks is necessary is let the jury take a look at that terrible-looking scar up there on her forehead. He rests. Motion for a non-suit because there's been no proof of damage. Now, you're going to get the question squarely before a court in a situation like that, which, you see, relates back to what we're saying here, as to whether or not, without a description of it in the record, without something for an appellate court to look at, what can the appellate court say that there was evidence when, from the bare record, you can't see a thing except the jury look at the woman? Maybe there isn't any scar there. Maybe the defendant's just happy to have her walk down and look at it, too. But there's no stipulation. You see what I'm getting at?
You'd have a good grounds to take it up and to get it.
I think a defendant might win on that. Now, do we want to make the guy go forward if the jury can look at this girl and she looks like she's 25, right while she's in the courtroom, and this is 3 months after the incident?
Take a picture of
her. I don't know you.
Of course, that goes to, there's no way around that one.
Well, the only way we're ever going to get around it is when we go to a
color TV of trial.
Well, let me ask you this. Taking that situation, if we go just to the defense, and as I understand it, Don, if we just raise it, it can go to the jury. If it's just a defense as opposed to affirmative defense, he would still have to do more than just to. He's got to do something, doesn't he? Other than just stand up and say that in his opening statement that my client thought she was over the age. By raising it, you've got to do something.
Yeah, he's going to have to put in some evidence. Yeah.
So you.
All right. So aren't you doing enough when you say to him, "Is it a defense for the actor to prove instead of saying prove by a preponderance of the evidence?"
Well, it's a question of how clear do we want to make the
ACLU?
How clear do we want to make?
I've belonged in my life. I'll go along with Bud. Let's leave it this way, and I think that we may get hit with.
Now, there's a section that, and I anticipate that we will have something comparable to this applied generally throughout this code, and that now the model penal code approaches it that. On affirmative defenses that no person may be convicted of an offense unless each element of such offense is proved beyond a reasonable doubt. In the absence of such proof, the innocence of the defendant is assumed. Of course, that's nothing new. But then it goes on to say that subsection 1, which I just read, does not require the disproof of an affirmative defense unless and until there is evidence supporting such defense, which would answer your question that he would have to put in evidence. But once he puts in evidence, then you have to have some evidence to disprove it.
Well,
by beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, but the state actually wouldn't have to come back with something else. So they could rely on what they've already shown in their case in chief.
Oh, yeah.
I assume they will put on their strongest cases at that point if they can anyhow.
Then they go on to say...
Wouldn't be entitled to anticipate the defense.
They'd have an opportunity for rebuttal, but I don't think it means that once he starts putting in some things like look at her and here's some pictures of her back a year and a half ago when this alleged offense occurred and so on. I don't think that means that the state then has to come back with something. Certainly, they'd have the opportunity to rebut as they do, but I don't think that means to you, Don. That means that they then must necessarily, time wise, chronologically, produce some new evidence. Their case in chief that may have been sufficient to carry it beyond a reasonable doubt, even though he does raise the question and put in some evidence.
Yeah, but of course, in a rape case, the state in its case in chief isn't going to put anything in with respect to the reasonableness of what the defendant believed or any question about mistake.
Well, all I'm saying is they can, though, if they desire. They could go into her appearance and the whole bit and her actual age if they desire.
Not to disprove a defense that's not been raised.
Yeah, there you're anticipating a defense if you do that.
I'm saying is the same evidence whether you put it in chief or rebuttal. I don't think the mere fact that the defendant puts in some evidence means that the state has to if it feels it's already covered it. It doesn't have to come forward with something new at that point.
Because they could rely on the same evidence, for instance.
Oh, well, you
see what I'm getting at? Supposing they're just relying on the evidence they have put in the case in chief.
Or they could rely on the evidence the defendant puts in. Picture of the girl.
Yeah.
They could say.
But you raised something interesting. Would a jury view be admissible when the crime happened a year and a half ago? In other words, you're not looking at the same girl, really.
Yeah, but this can't help but help hurt. This can't help the defendant. He's not the guy that he's being hurt. He's being an advantage, but he still might be the only thing he wants to rely upon. It.
Well, would the court allow the jury to take her appearance into consideration now when the crime happened 2 years ago?
I think that insofar as the...
With a young girl, 2 years,
I don't see
a great deal
problem with the defendant, Roger. If he wants to just raise it that way, he's the only one who can possibly be hurt by the passage in time. The state can't be hurt by the passage in time.
Well, see if I understand this correctly.
Well, I would think the state would be hurt, since she would look a great deal older at trial than she did at the time of the crime.
You're right.
In other words, I would think
that
the prosecution would object to the admissibility of that type of evidence altogether, saying, well, this isn't the same girl.
Yeah, you're right.
Too remote.
Mm. But Don, if the state, they have to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant comes forward with a defense of mistake as to age. To rebut that, the state they're not put upon a beyond a reasonable doubt negative proving that defense is not available. I mean, they just have to rebut it. They have to have some evidence to rebut it, and that's it.
Well, I'm not so sure.
We don't want to impose that
No, I don't think we do, because their evidence, their contradictory evidence may be in their case in chief and may be in the defense's case itself on cross-examination of the defense witnesses.
What I mean is we don't want an instruction. If the defendant presents some evidence of mistake as to age, we don't want an instruction then that the state must disprove this defense by beyond a reasonable doubt. We just want...
Well, the only thing you have to prove is that you'd still be entitled to this instruction the defense would, that the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt every essential element of the crime. You may, by just allowing this kind of excuse, mean that they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and probably do, that the under the objective test, he didn't reasonably believe she was over the age.
Well, that's what I meant.
It kind of worries me there. That's quite a burden.
The only other way you can go back and say there is no excuse, no matter what, you just got to go back to the law as it is now, is there just isn't any excuse. Yet your peril, you deal with the kid on the on birthday eve.
Of course, the jury's going to be instructed in any criminal case that the burden's on the state to prove each and every material allegation beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is not going to be a material allegation. You're not going to plead this in your indictment.
No.
You're not going to...
It's not an element of the crime.
What?
Well, his belief or disbelief as to age is not an element of the crime.
No, but her age is.
Oh, the age, yeah. That's an element, but what he believed and the reasonableness of it is not an element.
It's not an element of the crime.
No. So they could just rebut it with some evidence or rebuttal and it would go to the jury and the jury would be instructed upon whether or not a reasonable man under the same similar circumstances would have believed.
We're, of course... We're assuming an underlying assumption of this whole darn thing that we've just made is that the state is, on some valid evidence other than just the girl's own testimony, going to be able to prove that she was under the, say, the age of 16. And what about the case where the state can't do that except by her general appearance and so on? Are they ever going to be entitled to go to the jury? Suppose that she was born in Vietnam, and there are no records.
Can't do it now. In other words, that's okay. No worse than...
Right, you think right now, but you mean unless they can prove by the Bureau of Vital Statistics or something?
Parents
or something like that. Kind of. Suppose we got the orphaned child that gets over here on an adoption basis or... comes for medical treatment, then stays here, or something of that kind. And the only thing in the world you're going to have is her evidence of her age. Is that enough? If she testifies, I was under 16. Yeah, I'm not sure whether it is or isn't. Under present law.
If there's one thing that it would be hearsay, that's one thing that would seem to me that a person is totally incapable of testifying. That is his personal knowledge of his own age.
It's one of the things we allow as a pure... without calling an exception, really, but it's one of the few things a person can testify, I'm 14 years old or I'm 83 years old, and it raises a question for the jury, and it's purely hearsay, we know it.
Yes.
Where are we?
Because I was told I was born at such and such a time. Some of them want.
No, I tried.
Well, where we are is whether or not you're going to say it's a defense for the actor to prove by preponderance of the evidence or leave it where it is and let the court wrestle.
See, the Model Penal Code says when criminality depends on the child's being below a critical age other than 10, it is a defense for the actor to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he reasonably believed the child to be above the critical age.
All right, as a policy matter, I'm willing to go for that. Now, I think that that anything else, if we're going to allow this excuse, that anything else gives puts too substantial a burden on the state. I'm willing to go along with you.
Okay,
I'll
take it to the big cheese
on that basis.
Well, I'll move, therefore, that we insert after the word prove. By a preponderance of the evidence.
All right, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. So opposed, nay. Carry.
Does that do violence? What about your next section?
You have the same problem.
Same thing in consent. I suppose that we're going to be
consistent that it should go in there, don't you think, Roger? Do you think there's any...
No, I think definitely, probably, I would think it'd be stronger. Mm-hmm. The mistake is to consent, because you're dealing with some rather difficult situations there.
Requiring look at the mind of the...
Yeah, mentally defective, for example, some feeble-minded child.
Well, Don, do you see any policy consideration for not making it the same there?
See, no, it'd be easier for a defendant to raise the mistake as to consent, perhaps the mistake as to age.
How about also objective versus subjective?
Well, Jean mentioned in her commentary here that there is no requirement the mistake be reasonable, since in most cases the only source of information about the mistake will be the defendant himself. This means that he will need to take the stand on his own behalf to prove the defense. At this point, the jury should be competent to judge his credibility. The defendant is given the opportunity to exculpate himself, but the state is not given the difficult burden of proving culpable knowledge. In other words, the state just has to prove the lack of consent and does not have to prove that the defendant knew that this person was in this condition.
Well, I suppose the subjective-objective would not be a problem here. This is subjective. This is what he believes.
Yeah, right.
But it has to be a fact first.
Yeah, he's just saying, in effect, I didn't know.
I didn't know she was asleep.
Yeah. She mumbled a lot, and I couldn't understand
her. I didn't know she was unconscious. She grunted a couple of times.
I know. Yeah. Think of the Johnny Belinda kind of situation.
Yeah.
She looked all right to me.
I ain't never been too choosy myself.
She always was quiet.
Shy girl.
Yeah, what's it?
I sleep with a pillow over her head.
Did you make it?
My golly, you are a sore.
You're not going to put preponderance in there?
Yeah, well, I think we should put it in there.
What do you think, Don? Should we put preponderance in there?